Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. For many, the celebration of the 250th anniversary of the founding of Lexington focuses on the social, economic, political, institutional, and historical arc from 1775 to the present. But what was life like in what became the Commonwealth of Kentucky before 1775? That's the question we're going to explore with Kentucky's First People, an interview series about the native peoples who, for millennia before 1775, inhabited the region. The series is co-hosted by archaeologist, National Geographic explorer, and author Chris Begley, and Gwen Henderson, education director at the Kentucky Archaeological Survey at Western Kentucky University.
I'm Chris Begley, and I'm here in the studio with Gwen Henderson.
Hi, everyone.
We're archaeologists, and Gwen, we've worked together for 40 years.
It's kind of embarrassing.
But we're both Kentuckians, and we're archaeologists that have worked in different contexts, and we're going to be talking about the first Kentuckians and all of this part of Kentucky's history that we often don't hear about, or if we do hear about it, it may not be particularly accurate.
I would say it's the longest period in Kentucky's history.
How long are we talking about here?
Well, we're talking about a time 12,000 years at least when indigenous people first arrived in Kentucky, and native peoples are here today. So it makes it a long, long time.
Now, one of the questions that I think every archaeologist asks themselves is, why does this matter? With all of the immediate pressing concerns that we have, why do we care about what happened 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago, 12,000 years ago?
I think the short answers are, by being aware of the past, we can appreciate the past, we can accept the past, however it is. It gives meaning to our lives. You as a person are not just you now. You're a product of your own history and your family's history and your community's history.
And I think that's a good point. Most of us listening are not descended from people that have been here 12,000 years.
That's right.
We're recent immigrants to this area. But one of the things that's very clear is that the place where you are becomes important to you. You are, to some degree, a product of your place, and understanding that place is important, regardless of your particular history in that area.
And the other thing, too, I think is important for folks to remember, Chris, is that the place we are in right now is the place where ancient Native peoples were. Our home was their home. The hills we see and the rivers that we see might be a little different looking now than in the past, but they're the same place. And the significance of place and the role place plays in someone's identity and meaning is absolutely the same.
Let's talk just a second about archaeology and how we know these things. Now, many of us know that writing was invented somewhere around 6,000 years ago. And of course, for the first thousands of years, only limited things were the subject of that writing, right? How do we know what happens before that?
As archaeologists, we know the significance of objects, the role objects play in our past. And the patterns of those objects in place tell stories, stories that aren't written down in documents, stories written on the land. So as archaeologists, you and I know that by analyzing these fragments of people's history and understanding how the patterns compare, contrast, and complement each other, we can look into the deep, deep history of people whose only tangible record are those objects and those places where those objects are.
And, you know, in some ways, it's like when you investigate anything, you have the accounts that people may give of what happened. That may be accurate, maybe not. And then you have the other sorts of evidence that you could look at. You know, somebody says, did you wash the dishes? And I said, yes, I did. And it's very clear I did not, because they're all sitting there in the sink. That, to some degree, is where archaeology comes in that sense that it is a whole other set of information that helps us flesh out these stories.
And Chris, let's not forget, there are stories that don't show up in the history books. Stories of minorities, stories of children, women, African American, Native American. The archaeology is there telling their stories, whether or not they appear in the written history books.
The victors write the history, right? And the powerful people are who shows up, and people that are marginalized in any of those ways may well either not show up or show up in a way that doesn't actually represent what was going on.
The artifacts are written by the people, not by the victors.
Now, thinking about those histories, in my experience as an archaeologist, you know, working around the world, there seem to be a lot of misconceptions about our past here compared to many other places. And that's one of the things that we're going to be exploring in this series, some of those misconceptions from, you know, the famous Kentucky was a hunting ground where Native Americans did not live, which, not to spoil it, but that's not true, to even a sense of how long people have been here.
Right. People think that many different kinds of spear points and arrowheads in one place are a representation of an ancient battlefield. And that's informed because people think Kentucky was only a hunting ground. Multiple kinds of spear points and arrowheads means that many people found that place a good place to live. Here's another stereotype. Ancient Kentucky was a virgin forest. Not to spoil the story, but that is also not true.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about that, in fact, on the way over here to the studio. When we start this story 13,000 years ago or more, the climate here was different. The forests were coniferous forests, maybe like what you'd see in Michigan or Canada.
Exactly.
4,000 years ago, before people were farmers, the makeup of the forests were completely different because of the use of fire. And so what we're looking at, just like in every other natural place, demonstrates the impact of people.
Exactly. And how can it not be? People draw their livelihood from the environment that surrounds them. I think to be human is to manipulate the environment, honestly. And ancient Native peoples manipulated their environment just as we do today. Clearing areas, building houses, setting fires, building fish weirs, creating trails. All of this is impacting the environment.
And this goes back to sort of why this is important. Almost every archaeologist, worth their salt at least, is out there in the community doing another thing that you've done a lot of, which is educational work to sort of bring this kind of discussion to kids in grade school, for instance.
Well, and I know that you and I had a conversation several years ago hoping that we could pursue a variety of platforms, if you will, to bring this information or make this information available to interested folks, whether they be school teachers or people who are interested in Kentucky history. What I really hope for this series is that people will be amazed, surprised, challenged, interested, and appreciate this deep indigenous history that is our Kentucky heritage.
Yeah, and I think the kinds of people that we have lined up to interview and to come in and talk about this is really impressive and really comprehensive, not just going to be me and you talking about this.
No. The experts that will be coming in will be able to provide us an understanding and a perspective on the earliest people who arrived, the hunter-gatherers who were here, and the different ways hunter-gatherers lived across this diverse place that we call Kentucky, and then conversations about plant domestication, stone tool manufacture, building houses, making pottery, perspectives on mound building and earthworks construction. Indigenous history is as diverse as, well, the population of Kentucky today.
And I guess maybe just to finish on one thing, we're talking about, you know, the indigenous history of Kentucky in the distant past, but that is not something that ended there.
No.
I mean, there is still indigenous Kentucky, Native American presence here that is also part of a misconception that we often have.
Indigenous peoples are the descendants of the people who lived here long ago and are part of the tapestry of our history.
Well, Gwen, I'm really glad that we're doing this. I'm really glad that you're going to be here with me.
Absolutely.
To talk about this stuff. So
I look forward to the series.
Yeah, me too. Thank you.
One of the state's 15 area development districts serves Floyd, Johnson, McGoffin, Martin, and Pike counties. That's an area that includes places that have taken pretty hard hits in the latest flooding. Blake Moss is with the Big Sandy Area Development District, and we had invited him to talk with us about their FIRE program. FIRE stands for Fueling Innovation, Revitalization, and Entrepreneurship. And that federal-state partnership is still our focus, but with a bit of a new twist as the program is being pivoted to help businesses recover from flood damage. Thanks for joining us, Blake.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to talk about how this program is going to help businesses that were impacted by that. But first, let's get into the nuts and bolts of the FIRE program itself. What is it?
So FIRE was created essentially off my boss, Joe Jacobs, and I going to a lot of different meetings at the Area Development District for a wide variety of things. And a lot of these meetings were kind of meetings that you just went to and you didn't really get a whole lot out of usually. So as we went to these meetings, we started seeing trends and needs in the business community. So we started doing our own research. I reached out to the Secretary of State's office and he provided a staggering statistic to me that we have a 4.4% small business to population ratio. So for every 100 people in our region, about 4 of them are business owners compared to a national average of 10. So that told my boss, Joe Jacobs, and I that something really had to be done. So we took action, found some different databases and softwares that we thought could help us inform decisions. We wrote this grant to the Appalachian Regional Commission and got it. So the idea is that we use these two web databases, Resimplify and Placer AI. One is location data, and one is a automatically updated property database with all commercial properties in our 5 counties. So the original idea is to combine these together, have a hands-on business development specialist whose only focus is working with businesses, and do as much as we can hands-on help.
So let's say I want to start a small business or I'm already in business and I come to you for help. What can I expect?
You can expect us to figure out your needs, right? And you won't have to come to us. That's the big thing. We will come to you.
Oh,
we
okay.
Will never expect a business owner to come to our office. That's what makes our program unique. Jeremy Goodson, our business development specialist, meets businesses where they're at and sticks with them throughout every step of their process. So we don't have the tools for everything, I will say that. But the cool thing about this program is we have partners who can help you with almost anything. So a lot of this is us figuring out your needs and connecting you to our partners.
You mentioned tools, and I understand that you're using advanced technologies and artificial intelligence. How are they being applied?
Yes. So we have Placer AI. What Placer AI does is it harnesses cell phone data that is anonymous and categorized. So essentially, we can develop user profiles for certain areas, like specific addresses, specific towns, zip codes. We can even draw a more specific area, and we can figure out the type of people that frequent that area, the foot traffic, the vehicle traffic, and things like that. So we can help new business owners find their first storefront, current businesses expand, and we can also help current businesses figure out what their user preferences are in their area.
So I mentioned this was up and running, and then this flood came along. And when we talked earlier today, you mentioned that you're kind of pivoting the FIRE program to help out with flood recovery. Tell us more about that.
Yes. So we're still going to be doing our regular FIRE program, But we realize that a lot of businesses aren't going to be looking at these things that the fire program looks at. So we're kind of expanding ourselves to be that shoulder to cry on and that one-stop shop resource for our small businesses that have been affected. So we don't have answers to every problem, but what service we do offer is we're developing a resource bank. So we're working with all of our partners, like the Southeast Kentucky Chamber of Commerce, One East Kentucky, Mountain Association, and dozens of others to develop this resource bank that we can use to connect businesses to what they need. So if you need $5,000, $10,000 to start up, we'll try to help you find that. If you need help navigating through this FEMA process or any other bureaucratic process, we're here to do that as well. We're very uniquely positioned because we work with the government all the time. So we have private business connections, but we can also help you navigate government programs.
Is that federal government as well?
Yes.
And federal funding?
Yeah, so we can navigate the FEMA programs. We can help you apply for grants and loans and things like that. And like I said, the main part of FIRE is we're sticking with these business owners every step of the process.
Have you actually done some cases yet, or are you just now getting ramped up with it?
Yes, we're working with two businesses right now already that have specifically contacted us for help with disasters. So we're trying to navigate them through some processes. Unfortunately, we're still waiting to hear about individual assistance through FEMA.
How widespread is damage to business there, would you say?
Extremely widespread. I would say all five of our counties have dozens of businesses that have been affected at minimum. And I know Coal Run was the most affected. I don't remember the specific number, but I believe 166 structures have been affected there, and half of those are small businesses.
Wow. So, Blake, somebody hearing this and they think, yeah, that sounds good. I need that. How do they reach out to you to get in touch?
They can check out our website, bigsandy.org, and go to our business services page, or they can reach out to me directly through email at blake.moss@bigsandy.org.
Okay, that's Blake Moss, Public Administration Specialist at the Big Sandy Area Development District. And thank you so much, Blake.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, history.
We can date our history of the literary arts back to 1775 when the city was named.
Horses.
Not everybody wants to pet a police car, but most people want to pet a police horse.
And haints.
A haint is an Appalachian term for a ghost.
And Lexington's new youth poet laureate. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
The WEKU app is redesigned and totally updated. We've made it easier to play the live streams of WEKU and WEKU Classical. You can also find WEKU podcasts and NPR podcasts all in one place. There's more information on what's playing on WEKU Classical. The updated WEKU app is available in the Apple App Store and on Google Play.
You're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. I'm Tom Martin. April is a special month and a special year in Lexington. On the line with us is Carnegie Center Executive Director Jennifer Maddox. Jennifer, April is 250 Lex Literary Month, and you have some events planned on the Carnegie Center calendar. What's up?
Well, thanks to a 250 Lex grant, we've got several events happening all throughout the year. But the ones in April we have are a 250 Lex special edition of the Kentucky Great Writers Series on April 15th. And we also will have Richard Taylor as our guest MC that evening. Then we have on April 22nd, the Kentucky Black Writers Collaborative's Burn the Mic event. It will feature Monet Proctor and Renee Rigdon, two Lexington poets. And we will also have an open mic for anyone who would like to read. And then throughout the month of April, we will have a Larkspur Press gallery exhibit, and it will feature broadsides of works primarily by Kentucky writers. So you'll see signed broadsides from Jane Gentry Vance, James Baker Hall, Wendell Berry, not a Lexingtonian by birth, but he also went to Kentucky at UK, and many others. So it's going to be a really special month, and we hope people will come and see us. We're downtown right off of Gratz Park near Transy, 251 West 2nd Street.
And we'll claim Wendell Berry.
We will definitely claim Wendell Berry, yes.
All right. That's Carnegie Center Executive Director Jennifer Maddox. Thanks so much, Jennifer.
Thank you.
And there's more. We caught up with the city's arts and culture director, Heather Lyons, after a press conference detailing what's going on.
We have a lot of wonderful events taking place in April. That includes our April 8th event, which is a literary celebration, an evening inspired by the written word. That will be at the Kentucky Theater at 6:30 p.m. There's also a conversation with Nikki Finney at the Northside branch of the Public Library on April 9th. It Is Written are live performances and visual art creations by Tony Wavy and other local hip-hop artists. Those are taking place over 3 different days at different Lexington Public Library branches, so check that website. So there's Poetry at the Table at the beginning of the month, Teen How, and the Kentucky State Poetry Society's open mic event. And then throughout the month, the Lexington Public Library has wonderful exhibits at their central branch of historical artifacts, literary artifacts, early newspapers, magazines, books. That's really beautiful. A lot of people that work within the literary arts are very familiar with the long history of literary excellence in Lexington. But I would say for the community, they may be aware of a single writer or a single book that was very well publicized. But to look at it as a whole collective, Lexington is a real powerhouse in the literary arts. And so when we can date our history of the literary arts back to 1775, when the city was named, that makes it a very, very significant part of our history, our culture. So it just seemed absolutely essential that we devote a good part of our anniversary year to the literary arts.
Lexington Arts and Culture Director Heather Lyons. Think about it. How many cities around the country are home to both a state and a national poet laureate? Thinking here of Silas House and Ada Limon. Lexington also has a budding literary future. Eva Alcaraz-Monhay is the Carnegie Center's 2025 Lexington Youth Poet Laureate. That's a prestigious program. It is in partnership with Urban Word NYC and the Kentucky Arts Council. It honors young writers and leaders in Kentucky between 13 and 18 who are committed to making a civic impact through community engagement through the power of their written and spoken words. Eva is a senior at Lafayette High and this year's co-editor-in-chief of the school paper, the Lafayette Times. This is Eva's second year as editor-in-chief and third on the Times staff. Eva is also a SCAPA student majoring in literary arts. And outside of the Times, they participate in the Multicultural Association, Student Y, and National Honor Society. Eva, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Hi, it's so great to meet you.
So how was it for you to be chosen as this year's Lexington Poet Laureate?
I remember the moment when I was announced. I, like, stood up, and I felt, like, catatonic. It was, like, I wasn't expecting it. The year before, I was a finalist for Youth Poet Laureate as well. That was my first year applying. And even though I didn't win, I am a little bit grateful that I didn't win because the person who did it did an amazing job, Zoya Abbas. She's so awesome. Even though I didn't win, I was not sad that I didn't win. I was really confident in myself, and that really pushed me and made me feel like a writer, and it gave me kind of an energy that I think I needed at the time. And this year, I applied again, and I was a finalist, and it was a really great group of finalists. Like, all the people in that finalist group are people in the creative writing program at Lafayette, and they're all absolutely amazing writers. And I knew that if I didn't get it, if one of them got it, they'd do an amazing job. So I was not worried about the outcome at all. But I'm so grateful that I was given this opportunity to be a Youth Poet Laureate, because I really want to use this for good and to help people. I think poetry and creative writing is, like, really important, and especially, like, right now with all the things going on. I think it's a good creative outlet, but it can also mean something to people, and it can help people.
What are you thinking about? What are some ways that you might use it?
Well, I know that I use a lot of my poetry to talk about my culture, my history. I talk a lot about the way I grew up, the way my parents grew up, the places I lived. And I kind of think that gives an insight into myself, but also into the people I represent. And during high school, I really realized that education is, and, like, talking and sharing your experiences is the number one barrier to understanding with people, because there's a lot of ignorance in the world, but I think a lot of that ignorance comes from a place of just not knowing or not understanding. And when you start that communication and start talking with people, there's an understanding there.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're originally from Miami, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And for a time after you relocated to Lexington, you were not crazy about your new home. But over time, that changed. Tell us all about that transition.
Yeah. So I was born and raised in Miami. I lived there until I was about 11 years old. And then I moved to Indianapolis. I moved down here in Lexington to the summer of 2022. And I was really sad to leave Indianapolis because I had finally kind of opened up. The pandemic was, it was like in its waning stages. And I had found like a group of people at the time that I really liked, and leaving that behind was really hard. And I came here, and it was also just an environment that I was not very familiar with. Lexington was so much smaller than, definitely 10 times smaller than Miami. Indianapolis is also really huge. It's not as big as Miami, but it's up there. And it just felt small and isolating. And it just, It took me a while to get used to the people around me, the way that people talked. It was very different than the way that I grew up. And I didn't really see my culture or people that were like me that were really represented in the general population, but also like in the places I went. And like in school, there's only about like a, I think it's like a 13 to 15% of Latinos in the school. And I was going to schools that were like 50 to 60% Latino. So that was a really big change for me. But it kind of pushed me to, like, make myself seen and help make my community seen at my school and around Lexington. So I'm kind of grateful for it.
You know, one thing that I often hear from people who've relocated to Lexington from larger cities is that they come to find that the human scale of Lexington is really appealing, in that there is lots to do here. There is a pretty good cultural scene, yet it's contained within a city of 400,000 people, and it's easier to get to know people, for example. Do you agree with that?
I definitely think so. I think when you get to Lexington, you don't expect it to be so big and to have so much culture and history, but it really did shock me. I think especially in these last 2 years where I've really started making myself seen in the writing community, participating in things like Teen Howl and doing like things with the Carnegie Center, seeing all the writers and all the people interested in the arts in this community that you really wouldn't see is really amazing. And also something that I appreciate about Lexington is that everybody's kind of interconnected, like the art community. I think like everybody kind of knows each other or has like a vague idea of each other, which is kind of nice because it's like you have a jumping off point. Like if you're starting somewhere new, it's never completely new. You kind of already know somebody or you have a feeling about it. So that's something that I've really liked. And on the drive here, my dad was talking about how something that really surprised him when he moved here is that people wave at you and people like smile and wave. And like in Miami and Indianapolis, people don't really do that. And I think it's kind of like that Southern hospitality that's kind of seen here. The people are... people are really nice, at least outwardly, towards you. You kind of feel like at home with people. I think it's easier to connect with people sometimes because I think people in Lexington can be very welcoming.
You've actually written a poem titled "Appalachia is Contagious." Can you share that with us?
Just a little bit of background. This poem, "Appalachia is Contagious," is something that somebody very close to me said. We were mushroom hunting and we were just talking about like the nature, and they said the line "Appalachia is contagious," and it was like that just like it stuck with me for some while, and I decided to write this poem about kind of how Lexington has impacted me, or like just the way that I feel. "Appalachia is contagious. I've begun to light cigarettes at noon, watching the smoke bend across conifers that reek of corn syrup. I bless your heart to those I do not love, because they know that I don't. My neck bears a cross that I don't believe in, tarnished iron with simple remembrance of God and someone with him. I down ale like honey nectar, sugar caking the gas station t-shirt I found on the rack for spare change. A knife is secured in my back pocket with loose denim thread and an urge to flick it open like swings on a midnight playground. Watch me drive on roads that don't want to be paved, bumping some heathen music alongside the cows and the horses and the buzzards. My soul aches for coleslaw and grits and potato salad because this is y'all our family love, and I am tired of denying it.
That's wonderful. You know, Eva, there are so many options for expression in the arts. What is it about poetry in particular that attracts you?
So me and poetry have a pretty complicated history. When I first started writing, actually until pretty recently, I really disliked poetry. It never really clicked in my head for some reason. It never felt right, or I thought the way that I expressed myself, it just didn't feel right to me. But over the summer, I participated in this thing called Governor School for the Arts, and that's where I realized that poetry was something more than what I was taught. And it was due to the tutelage of Mackenzie Berry. She's a Louisville-based poet, and she exposed me to poetry that I had no idea about, or like the way that it could sound or the way that it could make me feel. And that really like pushed me to write poetry a lot more. And after GSA, during GSA, one of like our capstone projects was to write a chapbook, which is just like a collection of your work. And mine ended up being like 30 pages of poetry. And it was because I felt really passionate about it. And I don't know, I think poetry lets you say things without like you actually saying them. I think implications and connotations are a really big part of it. And it's fun to play around with, especially like the form is really fun. This poem, like Appalachia's Contagious, it has certain places where I have like broken up the lines specifically to make certain meanings. And I have another one that I've isolated certain lines because I want emphasis on this, or I've kind of mushed these things together because I want to make like an impact. And it can be very fun, and it can mean, especially like looking at poetry, just the way on a page, it can mean a lot without you actually like having to say it out loud. And I also like poetry. It can be short and sweet, or it can be like really long and drawn out. And it's kind of a form that's very forgiving, and it can kind of be whatever you want. And that's what I've really liked.
So we know that you write poetry and you have interest with the school newspaper. What do you do in your free time?
That's a complicated question because, frankly, I don't have a lot of free time. I do a lot of extracurriculars with, like, things that I enjoy. I do this thing called Student Y, which is a civics-based organization. And one of our things is Model UN, and I'm leaving for that tomorrow. I'm going on a trip to Louisville representing a specific country and talking about things. I like volunteering. I volunteer with this organization called Un Abrazo Amigo, and it's a Lexington organization that supports Latino families who have children with autism, Down syndrome, like different disabilities. It kind of gives them a community space, and I've really liked working with them. Outside of that, I watch a lot of TV, watch a lot of movies. I like making jewelry for like my friends and for people that I love. I like going around downtown a lot. I think downtown is one of my favorite places in Lexington. I've been walking around downtown, I think, since the summer of 2023 because I worked at the Central Library for the summer. And there would just be days where I just walked around a lot. So I know a lot of downtown, but it's still just so comforting to me because it's that big city environment that I grew up with. And it's just like very loving and comforting.
We really appreciate you taking time to come over here and talk with us, and wish you the best of luck with what you're doing, representing poetry for the year and youth poetry in Lexington. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. It was so great to be here.
That's Eva Alcaraz Monhay, the Carnegie Center's 2025 Lexington Youth Poet Laureate. We have a new series about animals in our lives, all kinds of animals. Natalie Voss Nevels is hosting, and she begins with Sergeant Brian Creekmore and Officer Allison Winters from the Lexington Police Department to talk about those mounted patrol unit horses you often see around town.
People might have seen officers around town on horseback, and I'm thinking one of the first things they might wonder is, why are there mounted police? Like, how do horses help you do your job?
Several different reasons. Our horses that we currently have are all draft horses or draft crosses, which means they're pretty large in size. So if you can imagine the size of that horse and what they're able to do, it helps provide a command presence, which is a big thing in police work anyways, as officers. But when you add that visual of the horse, it can just help to de-escalate situations. If there's, for instance, a large disorder that it would take several, maybe dozen or so officers to break up, you can see two officers coming down on horseback, and just the sight and sound of those horses approaching, it will help break things up and de-escalate much quicker. So those two officers are able to do the same amount of work as, you know, 10 or even 12 officers can on foot. And we always ride in pairs because the horses are herd animals. So we always have our beat partner with us, both for the officer and for the horse as well.
What kinds of situations and locations around town might listeners see the mounted officers?
Most of the events that we attend are either local parades or school visitations or some kind of heavily populated outdoor event, because that's what is accessible to us and what we're going to be useful for. But we do also do patrol rides. We ride out in pairs anywhere in Lexington to just provide an extra police presence and assist where we can. We do like to ride downtown a lot, but we can trailer anywhere in Lexington. So you might see us somewhere like the Summit or Hamburg or sometimes even the Mall.
And how do people respond when they see an officer, two officers, I suppose, and two police horses coming down the road?
It's usually one or the other. They're either really excited and happy and want to come up and approach us, or some are a little skittish and, you know, taken aback. Because like I said, our horses are very large, so it can be kind of intimidating. But we are here in Lexington, the horse capital of the world, so a lot of the population here are fans of horses, and then they see us and they want to approach us. It's an opportunity for us to get to know those people and get to talk to them and make those community connections as well.
Have you had situations where you've been able to sort of convert somebody from being a little afraid of this extremely large animal to kind of getting a little more comfortable with them and with you?
Absolutely, yes. Because our horses are so well trained and their demeanors are so calm, some like thoroughbreds can have that. They're kind of wild and want to go run and do crazy things, but ours are so well trained. They're so calm. They're just so used to being exposed to people and being out there that they're big dogs. They want to be petted too. So yes, there has been times where people have been kind of taken aback by them, and we can encourage them, you know, it's just fine. If you want to touch just right here, he's going to love it. And they do too.
Now, how are the horses selected for the unit, and what kind of training process do they have to go to get ready to be out in the streets?
Our department has a few different rules for when we're selecting horses. One of them is that they have to be a gelded male. They also have to be between the ages of 4 and 16 years old. Generally, we will get a horse that is on the younger end, so around 4 years old is what we look for. They also have to be around 16 hands high. Hands is how we measure the height of a horse. One hand is 4 inches. So if a horse is 16 hands high, they're about 5'4", and that's up to their withers, which is where their back connects to their lower neck. So that's not the height up to the top of their head, that's the height to their back. After that, we just try to make sure that the horse has a gentle disposition so we can use them with people and that they are free of any vicious habits such as kicking or biting. And then once we select the horse, we'll use them for a trial period and do additional training with them to make sure that they are desensitized and will work well for what we need them for. For this reason, we have bought multiple horses from Asbury University because they run a police horse training program. So they will get young draft horse crosses and train them specifically to be police horses. And so that helps reduce the amount of training that they will need when they come to us when we buy through them. But we do have a few horses that we have had donated to the unit. They're both Clydesdales, and they've done very well for us too.
And for people who may not be familiar with what a typical riding horse would know, what sorts of things do you have to get them used to before they go out on patrol? I know there's kind of a big desensitization process and obstacle courses and all that sort of thing that they have to show that they're very comfortable with before it's okay to send them out.
We're constantly looking for additional training opportunities to get the horses exposed to as much as we can. And kind of in the equine industry, a lot of people will say, You know, they want their horse to be bomb-proof, which means they're not going to be scared of anything that they're exposed to. And to be honest with ours, we don't want ours to be bomb-proof. We want them to still be responsive, but we want them to be responsive in the way that is safe for the community. So a lot of times it'll just be things that we encounter while we're out on patrol on the streets, just noises that you wouldn't expect, like somebody working in their yard, doing yard work, and they have a tarp. Just the sound that the tarp makes. A horse can typically spook at that if they're not used to it. So we'll just take stuff like that that we see and experience and take it back and train that at our facility and, you know, try to get them exposed to as many different things as we possibly can.
It also helps to pick a horse that has a curious personality because different horses will react differently when they become scared. And of course, our horses will be scared from time to time, but we want to know that if they are, that they're going to be trusting their rider and that they're not going to freak out.
Makes sense. So how does an officer end up as part of the Mounted Patrol unit? What kind of experience do they have to have going in? What kind of training do they have to go through to be ready for this?
We have the same rules as every other specialized unit in the department. So essentially, all you have to get into our unit is 3 years of experience on the police department, and then we'll open it up for anybody to submit an application. We'll give them 10 days. Anybody in the department can apply. And then after those 10 days, we'll have open interviews for that position. Horse experience is not required. I myself, as the sergeant of the unit, had zero horse experience before I went to the unit. So it's been a huge learning curve for me. It obviously is going to be a little helpful if you have some kind of experience and might give you an upper hand on some of the others, but it's not a necessity. Once the officer gets selected into the unit, then we have about a 10-week new rider course. So that also depends on the level of experience of that officer. If they have no riding experience whatsoever, they're probably going to take that full 10 weeks, you know, to build their skills and get to where they need to be in order to test out at the end to show that they are ready. Like Officer Winters had expansive amount of experience before she came to the unit. So hers was able to get quite a bit accelerated, and she was able to prove her skill set much faster and was much easier to train somebody that had all that experience coming into the unit already.
Do each of you sort of have a favorite experience that you've had on patrol with your equine partner, some event that was especially neat to experience with them or a favorite kind of moment on the unit?
For me, I think my favorite, it's not one particular moment. It's just riding out in general our patrol rides, because that's when you see people who aren't expecting to see you. So when you see, you know, a parent and their kid walking downtown at the stores, and then all of a sudden the kid's pointing at the horse saying there's a horse, and we get to stop and say hi to them. I think that's where we really get to do our community engagement and make a difference. And so that's what I enjoy the most.
I think I would agree. Just that community engagement piece of it, where the vast majority of the time that we are out in the community, people are genuinely happy to see us, and they want to talk to us, and we want to talk to them too. And we want to show them that we're normal people just like you all are too, and you can come and approach us and talk to us. And then, you know, it's obviously different. We always joke and say that not everybody wants to pet a police car, but most people want to pet a police horse. So it's refreshing to have that positive side of the community engagement, and it's every time we go out.
Do each of you have a favorite horse on the unit? And if so, what about their personality makes them really, really a favorite for you?
I definitely have a favorite horse. So my horse that I'm assigned is named Houston. He's about 12 years old now, and he's 17 hands high. He's a thoroughbred Percheron cross. He's one of our two bays. And the reason I connect with him is that he's just a very playful, personable horse. He wants to come and see you, see people. And he just has such a lovable puppy dog personality that me and him have really connected. And I got to come out and see him when I was interested in the unit before I officially joined. And ever since then, we've just kind of clicked, and he's been my horse. And whenever he eventually retires, I plan on taking him home with me someday.
So mine would probably have to be Aiden. He's the grandpa of the group. He's our oldest horse. He's 18 years old this year. But he was the first horse that I was introduced to riding whenever I came to the unit. He and I, just that initial connection that I had with him, he's solid white. So he cleans up really well, and he's always usually an eye catcher whenever he goes out into the public.
I know you guys are, your unit is obviously, it's part of the Lexington Police, but you also have a nonprofit that sort of helps support your needs. Can you sort of explain how those things relate to each other and how the community can maybe help support what you're doing?
Yes, we have the Friends of Lexington Mounted Police. They're a 501c3 nonprofit organization. They're just extremely supportive of us. They're made up of people from across the community that have pretty much grown up in the equine industry. So they're just a wealth of knowledge
and can always give advice on things, especially to me being new to the industry. They do a lot of fundraising for us. Before I came to this unit, I didn't realize how expensive the horse industry is. So a lot of the gear, the tack, and all of that stuff that needs to be purchased for the horses, they exist to help us in that, to help alleviate the police side of the budget. And that's who really helps us for our annual training, the Mounted Police Colloquium. We host that along with, we partner up with the Kentucky Horse Park. And that is a training that we have out at the horse park at the All-Tech facility. This last year, we had almost 150 mounted police officers from across the country, including Canada. We had officers from California, Florida, the New England area. So that's one of our biggest fundraisers for the year. Everybody knows budgets are tight, and you know the same thing applies to us. They exist to support us, and they are definitely a huge, huge help.
Well, Officer Winters, Sergeant Creekmore, thank you so much for being here.
Absolutely. If you see us, come say hi for sure.
Know anything about the last miner of Hurricane Creek? Or the crying in the night? Or maybe that haunted antebellum property in Jackson County? Matthew Sparks and Olivia Sizemore have investigated these and many other legends for their new book, Haint Country, Dark Folk Tales from the Hills and Hollers. And they're here to tell us more. Matthew and Olivia, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you for having us. Good to be here.
So first, let's get a definition out there. Haint. That's H-A-I-N-T. What's a haint?
A haint is an Appalachian term for a ghost. It is derived from the term haunt. It is cognate people hear, like in the deeper South, like the Gullah Geechee dialect, they talk about like haint blue being the color of the porch ceilings to keep haints away. I've learned how quickly this term has fallen out of fashion. I actually grew up by my dad using this word with me and my neighbor. Like, people would refer to ghosts as haints. So for me, growing up, this was very, very normal, even though I think it sounded extremely Appalachian when I would tell my cousins these tales from that were from elsewhere. But yeah, like, I grew up hearing this word in common parlance.
In the book's foreword, Jordan Lovejoy, a visiting instructor of American Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, specializing in folklore, raises a couple of points that I'd like to explore with you. First, a perception that very much endures to this day, and that's that English in Appalachia is a survival of Elizabethan English. She says not so.
When you get into linguistics, which I have a little bit of study in, you know, I'm a bit multilingual, you have, like, there's a direct line. It's very rare that you can trace a direct line of, like, one language to another. Everything is always constantly evolving as people speak and talk and interact and shorten things and cut things and shift vowels and all that. Appalachians definitely do have a unique accent and a dialect that is undebatable, but I wouldn't say that it's like Elizabethan English is probably the foundation of it. I'm not sure.
I would say that people tend to forget how multicultural Appalachia really is, and there's so many myths about why the language sounds the way that it does in the mountains, but largely it's because of all the different groups that have lived in kind of commingled and existed there very close together and remote.
Well, again, Dr. Lovejoy, to mention her, she also writes in your foreword about the plausibility of folklore, the believability of stories that have been passed down through the generations. How did you sift through these tales to land on ones that are just plausible enough to leave us wondering if there might actually be something to this strangeness?
I would say that this whole thing kind of started in 2018 as a Facebook Messenger conversation of us sharing stories that we had heard growing up. And that gave us a really good foundation to sort of branch out just with people we knew. Another thing is, you know, we're both from the same county in Eastern Kentucky, which is Leslie County. We went to high school together. And there are a few events, namely the Hurricane Mine disaster, that sort of worm their way into the psyche of this community. And when you know about events like that, you know that there's usually going to be some sort of ghost tale or haint tale as a way for people to psychologically deal with that and remember it. When you talk about believability, a lot of the time these stories go back to real events, either ones that are widely remembered or ones that are just remembered as a haint tale.
I'd like to ask each of you, what do these stories, taken as a whole, reveal to you about human nature?
Oh, that's a very interesting point. I think a lot of humans have this desire to, I'm not going to say believes, but people want to, some humans want to like seek out something that is beyond the veil, so to speak. You know, people are very curious about what we can't know, what is out of our grasp. And the nature of living in these hills, in these areas, about how there's always an element of unpredictability and danger, and how people kind of warn and inform each other about experiences that they've had, about things that are not physical or not even real, maybe not even knowable, we can't know, but why they tell them and why also, as Olivia can probably elaborate upon, why they don't tell them or don't talk about them.
Mm-hmm.
And more just how in an area that's kind of as isolated and somewhat culturally unique as Eastern Kentucky is, the ongoing role that these stories play and what role they played in like allowing people to keep living in these hills, whether it's through the information or, you know, kind of lessons or morals or they relate, or just for the pure like entertainment. People like to seek out the unknown and test fate and test danger, and they like to tell stories about it.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, Olivia, how about you? Any insights on what you've learned about human nature?
I think there is a very human need to understand the unknown. I also think that it becomes like a way to talk about and kind of process uncomfortable events or ideas. We come from such a small community. Appalachia is largely made up of really small communities where people know each other. And my grandpa used to say, like, there's no secrets in a small town. So you'll have, you know, something that's maybe an upsetting idea or maybe an upsetting event, and people might get mad about it or might label you a gossip. Or, you know, there's sort of an attitude with some of these older generations of like, you just don't talk about sad things. I think a lot of the time, some of these tales become a mechanism to safely talk about them by putting them almost in a realm of unbelievability. If anybody actually gets mad, well, it's just a haint tale. It's not real.
All right. Well, that's Matthew Sparks, Olivia Sizemore. They're the co-authors of Haint Country, Dark Folk Tales from the Hills and Hollers. And thank you both for taking time for us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out our archive, our series, our partners, and sign up for our newsletter. You can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and podcast versions on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.